I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Since 1994 and the genocide in Rwanda, many world leaders have vowed never again. But how can you tell when violence and fighting are about to lead to mass killings and widespread atrocities? That's a question many are asking now because of the violence unfolding in another African nation, the Central African Republic. And it's our focus for the next several minutes. In a moment, we'll hear from author Philip Gurevich, who's long been thinking about what those vows of never again really mean.
I always say when people say never again, that's a very high standard. And you don't want to find yourself saying, well, this isn't that again. This isn't that again. You don't want to wait for, you know, Auschwitz or Rwanda before you say, okay, we've reached the threshold.
We begin, though, with the latest from the Central African Republic. Today, more than 100 people were killed in a new round of fighting there. Militias loyal to ousted President François Bozize reportedly attacked the capital city, now in the hands of former rebels. They took power in a coup last March. The violence has been going on ever since. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council authorized an intervention force made up of French and African troops to help prevent further escalation. Earlier today, I spoke with the BBC's Thomas Fessy on a bad phone line from the CAR.
Well, I'm in the northern town of Bosangoa, which, remember, has been the theater of tit-for-tat attacks and sectarian violence over the last 3 months. This town has seen the worst violence in the country. They are fighting goat out when both the Christian militiamen and the former rebels, who are mainly Muslims, were getting all the reports coming out of the capital, and both sides reacted with reprisal attacks here in Bosangoa.
So if I understand correctly, Thomas, and the line is not so good, you're saying that there is Muslim versus Christian fighting?
Yes. I mean, although it would be a little too simple to put it that way, but the violence that has broke out over the last few weeks and these ongoing here in the CAR is taking a sectarian turn, and we're seeing on the one side Christian communities fighting against the other side Muslim communities because of the atrocities that have been committed by both sides.
I keep hearing words like chaotic to describe the situation in CAR. What kind of a challenge is this to report? I mean, have you sorted out with any degree of certainty who is fighting whom?
I think that's a very good question, because anytime there is a fighting that breaks out, it takes more than an hour to understand who has fired the first shot, where did it come from which side, from which militia. So when we're talking about chaos in the CAR, it means that the violence is a bit all out. It comes from many sides, many different groups. It's not very orchestrated, not very organized, and this is why it is a sort of descent into chaos.
So another former French colony facing violence, and again, the French military is going to go in. What kind of impact will they have on this fighting?
Well, I think that's the main question mark. The French will have to contain both sides, and we have to protect the people along the main axis of the country. But remember that although this is a very big country, bigger than France, it is not densely populated.
The BBC's Thomas Fessy on the line from the Central African Republic. Philip Gurevich has thought long and hard about the forces that unleash the sort of chaos we're hearing about from the Central African Republic. Gurevich is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's also the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. Gurevich says using the term genocide for what's going on in the Central African Republic or anywhere else might have unintended consequences.
When people say never again, that's a very high standard. And you don't want to find yourself saying, well, this isn't that again. This isn't that again. You don't want to wait for, you know, Auschwitz or Rwanda before you say, okay, we've reached the threshold. But it seems to me that there's a terrible breakdown of any kind of protection by the state or by anybody there able to protect the civilian population from these various factions. But I'm not sure that calling it genocide is actually the best way to understand it, at least from what we've seen so far.
Not to understand it, but I mean, do you see a clear intent in the case of the CAR? I mean, and is it maybe too soon to call it genocide if it might be?
Well, it's certainly too soon to call it genocide if nobody can identify who's the genocidal perpetrator and who are the genocidal victims. I'm not there. I'm not an expert on Central African Republic. I don't want to pretend to be able to define a set of very grim circumstances that I'm not able to see. But I think that what we have right now is we have an escalation of international attention in response to a situation that's been going on for some time. And that escalation is linked to this claim of genocide or creeping genocide. And one has to ask, well, let's put it this way. If it turns out that it isn't really genocidal, but falls into some other very problematic category of communal violence linked to militia and civil war type violence, do we lose interest? Do we withdraw? Is genocide a hook for getting some sort of intervention at this point? Or are we saying that if it isn't genocide, well, sort of to hell with it, it's below the radar? Maybe that's what's going on, but we should be careful about the loose and sloppy usage of these terms. It doesn't help either the cases where it's correct to use them or the cases where we may use them as amplifiers inaccurately.
I guess international attention is a starting point, but what about the mechanics of stopping the violence that has already begun? I mean, do you think the international community and the UN, do they know more about what can be done to halt mass atrocities once the madness begins?
No, I don't think that there's any kind of exact experience on this. Obviously, we're looking at situations like Syria, where you have mass atrocities and nobody's sure what to do, because there is the feeling that you have a lot of very, very strong forces. The death toll is terrible. It's continuing. But nobody wants to get into that fight. And the risk of making it worse rather than calming it down with an intervention, nobody knows how to break it up. And nobody knows, most importantly, what they want it to look like when it's over in Syria. That is a consideration there. Now, in Central African Republic, I don't think anybody's thinking, oh, well, you know, this is like going into Syria, because you don't have an army like Assad's army. There's the feeling that this is relatively low-tech, the form of marauding bands. It doesn't seem to be anything like organized on the Rwandan scale, because the Rwandan scale was really a very systematic state-sponsored program of genocide, where the idea was to mobilize every community in the country.
Because Rwanda was more low-tech, I'm wondering, has anybody in the international community, are they looking at Rwanda and now looking at CAR and saying, ooh, we don't want another Rwanda?
I'm sure that's what they're saying. I think that always going by comparisons isn't ideal. They need to think about the very particular situation in Central African Republic. Rwanda has always been one of the most intensively administered and centrally organized and unchaotic countries. In Rwanda, the genocide was not chaos. It was order. It was a program. It was a system. That does not seem to be at the same level the case in Central African Republic. And so I think we have to be very aware of the complexity of something that we don't understand, and that simply jumping in, it may prevent the worst or a worse escalation, but it is very far short of a solution.
Philip Gurevich, a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Mays recently returned from a two-month stint in the Central African Republic. She's a nurse working for the aid group Doctors Without Borders. Mays was based in a town called Bourguila and traveled throughout the northwest of the country.
As we would drive past some villages, we would think that the village was empty and had been abandoned, but we would see people hiding behind houses because they would hear a vehicle coming and they had no idea who it was, because they would be attacked without any notice. So even though it's a very beautiful place, very lush and almost seems strangely peaceful because it's just so beautiful, you start driving around and start seeing different parts of the country and it's quite stark. I have also traveled to villages that have been burnt down and completely abandoned after attack. So it's a beautiful place, but quite a difficult place.
Was it clear where all the people had fled to?
No. And in fact, people will flee into the bush and there will be lots of rumors of where people are at any given time. And I was in one village shortly before I left and was trying to talk to some of the community leaders to find out where people were. And I would get a different answer from everybody because, you know, I would talk to the imams, they would tell me one story. I would talk to the pastors, they would tell me another story. So I'm not sure that it's a reflection of me so much as it is a reflection of just the fluidity of the situation and the increasing distrust that these different communities are having of each other.
The checkpoints along the roads, typically in lawless parts of Africa, these checkpoints for some reason just turn into the catch basin for some of the country's most unhinged soldiers in any country. What's it like in CAR?
It's like that. We had one pregnant woman who was trying to get to our hospital. She had a high-risk pregnancy. Her previous pregnancy, she had complications and had to have a C-section. And she was walking probably a good 30 kilometers to get to our clinic, came to a checkpoint. She was carrying a small quantity of food for her and her small child. And the soldiers who happened to be at this checkpoint didn't believe her story and made her wait for 6 hours while she's in labor. They thought that she was taking food to aid one of the other military groups. And finally, she showed them the scar on her belly for her previous C-section and said, please, I need to get to the hospital. This can be really serious. And they finally let her pass.
Now, you've described an incident involving another mother there in the CAR trying to care for all of her children during this conflict. One child was near death's door. What happened to her?
This mother had left her children with her other children with a neighbor. She didn't know where they were. She wasn't sure if they had fled to the bush, how things were in her village. And she had her other child was in our hospital and was dying of many complications of malaria, meningitis. It was quite a complicated case. And she kept talking to our doctors, being like, when is my child going to die? Why are you continuing to treat my child? I know my child's going to die. I need to get back to my other children, which is a very strange thing for medical workers to encounter, because for us, we try to work until the end to save every patient possible. But this mother's just trying to be realistic. She doesn't want her kids to be abandoned. She left them with a neighbor. She knew her child was going to die, or at least that's what she thought. And sadly, her child did die.
It must be kind of weird to be back in the States now and reading as this crisis kind of amps up. Is there a person or image that seems to keep coming back to you as you recall your time in the CAR?
There was a village that was attacked and pretty much burned down, and the population had fled into the bush, and we had supported a health post there. And so we had some of our staff who lived in that village and worked in the health post. And so we tried to go into the bush and track them down. And when we found one of our nurses in the bush, the first thing he said to me was, look, I brought the medications with me so I can treat people in the bush. And I just thought, oh my gosh, that is just so amazing. Here, this guy had to flee with his family. He has a lot of responsibility. He takes care of a lot of people. He has a lot of children. There's cousins and aunts and uncles who live with him. And yet he was concerned about bringing the medication so that he could continue to treat his patients in the bush. And that was quite touching.
Yeah, that's dedication.
Yes.
That mother who was stopped at the checkpoint that you were talking about earlier, that story does have a happy ending, doesn't it?
It does. She gave birth later that evening by C-section at our hospital to a healthy baby girl.
That's good news. Michelle Mays, a nurse working for the aid group Doctors Without Borders, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.